Science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard once allegedly said, "You don't get rich writing science fiction. If you want to get rich, you start a religion." Hubbard, famously, founded the Church of Scientology, one of the most controversial and secretive religions in the world. Hugh Urban is a professor of religious studies at Ohio State University. He's especially interested in how secrecy is used in religion. Urban's the author of The Church of Scientology, A History of a New Religion. He tells Steve Paulson why he calls L. Ron Hubbard a bricoleur.
That's a term that comes from the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, and he uses that to talk about the ways in which religious individuals pick and choose different pieces of many different things and put them together in interesting new ways. And I found that a really useful way to think about Hubbard, because he himself says that in the course of coming up with the idea of Dianetics and Scientology, that he explored everything. He explored automatic writing and clairvoyance and various chemicals, everything under the sun, in order to come up with his new science of how the mind works. And as he develops Dianetics, he's really incorporating many, many different things. There are elements of psychoanalysis, sort of popular therapy and self-help that was just getting going in the early 1950s. He eventually brings in elements of Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and puts it all together in this fairly remarkable new synthesis that became incredibly successful and popular in the early 1950s and then took off in the 1960s.
And before Hubbard created Scientology, he developed what he called a new science of the mind, which is what he called Dianetics. What was the basic premise here?
Well, the term Dianetics he used, taking it from the Greek dia and nous, meaning through the mind. And the idea of Dianetics is that all of our problems come through the mind, and therefore all the solutions come through the mind as well. Hubbard believed that he had understood how the mind really works, and he divided the mind into two basic parts: the reactive mind, which is very similar to the psychoanalytic idea of the unconscious, which is a repository of negative experiences that we have throughout our life. Moments of pain and unconsciousness become burned in the reactive mind in the form of what Hubbard called engrams, which are negative memory traces that then cause us problems in the future, both physical problems and psychological problems. The other part of the mind he called the analytical mind, which works like a flawless computer and sees the world accurately. And so the process of Dianetics involves going back and identifying where these negative memory traces lie, a process that he called auditing. And once you have identified and talked through these negative memory experiences, then they're cleared from your reactive mind. And eventually, once all of those experiences have been removed, you achieve the state called clear, which he described as an optimum state of psychological and physical well-being.
So when he started talking about Dianetics, did this movement gain much traction among people?
It did. It was a surprising success to everyone, including Hubbard himself. The book Dianetics, when it was published in 1950, went to the top of the New York Times bestseller list and remained there for 28 weeks. The movement really took off like wildfire across the U.S. It was really the first major popular form of self-help at the time. And there were small Dianetics clubs that popped up all over the country. The success of Dianetics did not last very long, only a year or so before the movement actually went bankrupt. And it was at that point that Dianetics in its early form sort of fizzled. And shortly after that, Scientology takes its place.
Why would Dianetics go bankrupt if it was so popular?
Well, part of it is that it was a decentralized movement. That is, anyone could read the book and start forming little Dianetics clubs around the country. So it was becoming very popular by word of mouth, but the revenue wasn't necessarily coming back to Hubbard himself. There are also disputes within the early Dianetics community between Dianetics and some of his early supporters who felt that he was increasingly authoritarian and that he was also pushing Dianetics in a direction that was increasingly unscientific. Initially, Dianetics was presented as a science of the mind, but very quickly he began exploring things that seemed to some supporters as non-scientific, such as past life experiences, reincarnation, and things like that.
So what is the difference then between Dianetics and Scientology? Because he basically moved from Dianetics to establish the Church of Scientology.
That's right. So Dianetics lasts for about a year or so, and then pretty much fizzles by 1952, 1953. And out of the sort of the ashes of early Dianetics emerges the Church of Scientology. One of the key differences is that Dianetics is focused primarily on this lifetime and examining, talking through, and clearing the engrams from this lifetime. very quickly, people who were practicing Dianetics began to believe that they were recalling past life experiences as well. And that's when Hubbard developed the idea of what he calls the Thetan, which is our spiritual self, which is eternal and lasts beyond this particular body. And he began developing elaborate ideas of past life experiences, some going back billions and trillions of years. So Scientology introduced a spiritual dimension that was not there in Dianetics. Well, that's one reason for the emergence of Scientology. Another is that Dianetics practitioners began to be investigated by the FDA and by different medical boards. Several practitioners of Dianetics in the 1950s were arrested for practicing medicine without a license. And so part of the reason for the shift from Dianetics to Scientology was a shift in the spiritual direction, so that if they're practicing a spiritual therapy and not making claims to physical healing, they're no longer under the scrutiny of the FDA and medical boards.
Now, the other thing that you say about the founding of Scientology is this was very much a religion that came into being during the Cold War. It was to some degree a product of that era of anti-communism. Can you explain this?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting parts of the development of Scientology to me. And so I really spent a good chunk of the book looking at that piece of the puzzle, Scientology's growth and development during the Cold War. And I made that argument for a couple of reasons. One, Hubbard himself presented Dianetics and Scientology really as the solution to nuclear war. Like others, he believed that the human race was probably going to destroy itself by nuclear war unless we learned how to control ourselves, as it were. So in promoting Dianetics and Scientology, he really presented it as the solution to the atomic bomb. Secondly, he was really concerned with communism throughout his writings. In the early 1950s, he wrote numerous letters to the FBI and to J. Edgar Hoover himself, identifying communist threats both externally and within his own organization. And third, I argued that the preoccupation that Scientology had with secrecy and security and information control is really a microcosm of the larger Cold War American concern with secrecy and information control. So not only did Scientology develop its own highly classified upper levels of training, like the OT3 levels, it also developed its own sort of intelligence office, the Guardian's office, which was concerned with sort of policing the flow of information within and without the Church of Scientology, and eventually became involved in really remarkable, elaborate espionage and counter-espionage with the IRS and other U.S. government offices.
We should talk about some of these more secretive practices. I mean, certainly one of the most controversial ones is called the OT3, the Operating Thetan 3, which I guess only advanced practitioners of Scientology get into. What is this?
So OT stands for Operating Thetan, and these are upper levels of Scientology auditing that go beyond the state of clear. So once you've achieved the state of clear, which you've cleared all your negative memory traces from this lifetime, then you enter these more advanced levels. The term or phrase Operating Thetan means a thetan or spiritual entity that's become more and more independent or free of the material world and eventually is claimed to have various supernatural abilities. So in the Scientology map, or what's called the Bridge to Total Freedom, there are listed 15 of these operating thetan levels. Hubbard only appears to have completed 8 of them before his death. The most controversial one is this third one, Operating Thetan Level 3, which is the one that reveals the story about Emperor Xenu and the past history of planet Earth and extra body thetans and all of that.
I guess I'm unclear. Why do you have to have this advanced level of practice before you would hear about this foundational story about the Emperor Xenu?
Well, according to Scientology literature and Hubbard's own statements, it would be dangerous for individuals who weren't prepared to have this information revealed to them. It could do psychological or even physical harm. He called Operating Thetan Level 3 the Wall of Fire. That was very difficult for him to break through and understand. And so individuals who didn't have the correct training just wouldn't be able to handle it, in the same way that if you didn't have the correct training to go rock climbing on a steep cliff face, you would be in danger.
Do you need the correct psychological training, the correct spiritual training, I guess?
Correct.
Why all the secrecy, though? I mean, why not just put all this out in the open and let people practice as they want?
Well, that's a real interesting, difficult, and controversial question. Cynics, of course, would say that the secrecy is there to protect its value. The operating thetan levels become quite expensive. To get to operating thetan level 8, it's been estimated that one would have to pay between $300,000 and $400,000.
$400,000? Who are you paying this to?
Well, they're listed as donations to the Church of Scientology. but they are set donations.
For what? I mean, what do you get for paying all that money?
The knowledge and training that one acquires through going through the auditing levels that accompany each of these operating thetan levels. And along with that, the increased freedom and independence of the thetan from the material world. And purportedly, one also has supernatural abilities. One of the things that Hubbard claimed was that a thetan who becomes increasingly independent can exteriorize or leave the body, can become clairvoyant. If you read accounts of Scientologists in many of Scientology publications, such as Advance Magazine, they claim all sorts of supernatural abilities from having gone through the operating thetan levels. Everything from being able to fix broken appliances to healing their pet cat to exteriorizing from the body and flying around the universe.
So you are a historian of religion. You know, you've looked at the histories of a lot of different religions. How do you look at this history and the stories that you hear about Scientology?
Many aspects of Scientology seem pretty out there to most Americans when they first encounter them. But if you think about it, many aspects of many religions seem pretty out there to those who don't grow up in those traditions. So if you told someone who'd never heard of Christianity the story of the Garden of Eden and that there was a talking snake and there was a tree with an apple and then they got kicked out of the garden, someone who had never encountered that story before would find that pretty strange. In the same way that someone who's never encountered Hindu mythology finds the stories about Shiva and Krishna and Kali and Durga quite bizarre, or someone who's never encountered Native American spirituality or African religions. So in that context, in the broader history of the kinds of narratives that human beings have come up with to explain the universe, the story about intergalactic Emperor Xenu really isn't that out there. I think it seems out there to most Americans because of the science fiction elements, knowing that Hubbard was a science fiction author, the fact that it's a new religion. When we think of ourselves as scientific and modern and rational, to have a story with this many unusual science fiction elements probably strikes most Americans as more bizarre than a Hindu myth written 2,000 years ago.
Well, there is also the question of whether Scientology actually is a religion, although you say in your book that you think that's the wrong question to ask, and the right question is, who gets to define religion?
Yeah. So what I argued in the book is that our definition of religion is always changing. So for example, in the mid-19th century, when Mormonism comes along, Mormonism was also considered crazy and a cult. Joseph Smith and his followers were chased halfway across the country. These days, however, Mormonism is one of the largest denominations in the world. Some consider it an independent world religion in its own right, with millions and millions of followers. So how we understand religion is always changing. And the period after World War II was a period in which it was changing very quickly, as we have new imports coming from the East and all sorts of new religions emerging in the United States. So I thought it was more interesting to think about how religion gets defined and who gets to define it. And it's really not a question of a few academics like me writing away in universities defining religion. Rather, it involves a whole number of different agents, including not just scholars, but also the religious practitioners. It involves courts, it involves lawyers, it involves government agencies like the IRS and the FDA, the State Department, et cetera, the media, journalists, et cetera. So it's really a much more complex conversation and debate that is always evolving and changing over time. So to me, that's a more interesting way of thinking about it than simply saying it is or isn't a religion, because 20 years from now, we'll probably be thinking about religion differently than we are right now.
Hugh Urban is the author of The Church of Scientology, A History of a New Religion. He spoke with Steve Paulson.